Welcome to the podcast of Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly health news magazine. I'm your host, Barbara Lewis. This free podcast is produced by WFYI Indianapolis in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters. I'm Barbara Lewis. Coming up next on Sound Medicine, have you seen the promotions for low-cost heart scans? Well, we had some questions.
We don't recommend doing screening tests just to find out unless it will change something that you do.
And what if they find something else at the same time? Our guest calls them incidental lomas.
The problem is that because it's not related to the particular condition you're looking for, it's hard to know whether it's important or not.
Plus, why some states want to allow unapproved drugs to be used in extreme cases.
This is a bit of an experiment in public policy as much as it is an experiment in medical care.
What's on the market and on the horizon to treat migraines?
But the hot news, the really hot news for migraine prevention was presented at the American Academy of Neurology.
And myths about sex. We'll talk length, timing, socks, and aphrodisiacs.
And that's often what people will say, is this works for me. And that's great if it works for you.
That and more. Next on Sound Medicine.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome to Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly news magazine about medicine and health. I'm Barbara Lewis. We begin this week where we often find ourselves, at the intersection of business and medicine. If you could take a test that costs just $49 and it would tell you whether you're at risk for a heart attack, would you do it? And what would you need to know about that test before making your decision? Low-cost heart scans are being promoted by hospitals around the country, so we wanted to know what they're testing, how effective they are, and whether they pose any risks. Dr. Pamela Douglas directs the Cardiovascular Imaging Program at Duke University's Clinical Research Institute. We asked her opinion of a common test known as the CAC scan, which stands for coronary arterial calcium.
A coronary calcium scan uses a very low-dose X-ray technology to look at whether or not there's some calcification or calcium accumulation in the walls of the arteries that lead to the heart. And that generally only occurs when there's also plaque or cholesterol buildup or narrowing of the arteries. Now, it can occur with plaque, but without a lot of narrowing, just as we age and we live our relatively not heart-friendly Western diet and sedentary lifestyle, it's extremely common for individuals to start having some thickening of the arteries or hardening of the arteries, as people may have heard, in the blood vessels leading to the heart. And this occurs as young adults. Even people in their 20s and 30s have this. So the calcium is a marker for that, which is very easily detected by this low-dose X-ray.
So how much information, though, does this test really give people about their risk of heart disease?
Well, it tells you whether or not you have this hardening of the arteries with calcification in it. Now, it doesn't tell you if there is a blockage in the arteries or if you're going to be at risk for a heart attack. Obviously, if you've got hardening the arteries, you're at a higher risk for a heart attack, 7 times higher in good research than somebody that doesn't have that calcium. So in that sense, it tells people that they are at higher risk than they would be if they didn't have the calcium. And it is conveying extra risk beyond what the doctor can get by looking at your blood pressure, your cholesterol, and so on, your conventional cardiac risk factors.
So the American Heart Association doesn't support the routine use of this sort of scanning for the general public. Why is that, and do you agree?
So the reason that it's not supported is that it's so common that it's not clear that it truly differentiates between people who are going to have a risk in the near term and those who don't. There also have been no prospective studies saying if you take a bunch of asymptomatic people and treat them on the basis of the scan results, you know, people who otherwise feel well, and treat their scan results, whether you would do anything beneficial to their risk of having a heart attack or of dying from heart disease.
Yeah, so in general, do you think this test is something that people should do through their doctor, or is it a good idea for people just to get it on their own, or a good idea to get one at all?
I think the tried and true cardiac risk factor assessments of going to your physician, checking your cholesterol, your blood pressure, your family history for diabetes is very well accepted, and I think a very good thing to do. If you get this test and it shows some calcium, it's a little unclear what you should do in the absence of other indications to treat with medicine. On the other hand, if somebody wants an extra motivator maybe to get out there and exercise more frequently or eat a healthier diet, then it could be beneficial for them, provided they act on the results.
Mm-hmm. So there a particular candidate, like a best candidate for this test that you would say, you know, maybe this is really beneficial?
Well, the absolute best candidate for this kind of test, and someone in whom the Heart Association actually does recommend that they get a calcium score, is somebody who is on the cusp as to whether or not they need extra preventive treatment for heart disease. So if somebody is young and healthy and has no risk factors, there's really no benefit. If somebody is older and has a lot of risk factors that need treatment anyway, there's not much benefit from getting the scan. But if somebody who's in between those two extremes, where a positive scan might push you over into a more aggressive preventive strategy where you treat your cholesterol more aggressively or you make more stringent diet and exercise recommendations, then this would be somebody in whom the scan might be useful.
Right.
And it is recommended for that kind of intermediate risk person to further risk stratify.
So what's behind this? I mean, why offer then those $49 heart scans? What would be in the interest of the healthcare system to do this?
Well, they're obviously getting paid for the scans. They're doing it either because the scan itself represents profit or because they feel that it's a loss leader to attract patients or potential patients into the health system.
So if you get a scan and you see the calcium on the scan, you might go to one of their cardiologists or you might sign on to a primary care physician to kind of explore what you can do about it?
Yes, exactly. And I don't want to be too cynical to say that that's not would not be important to follow up. It absolutely would be important to follow up. But, I mean, in terms of the hospital's interest, I think that it's related to an expectation of growing their patient population, which is what hospitals are supposed to do. They're supposed to treat patients.
So, Dr. Douglas, I mean, what's the take-home message here?
I think the most important thing would be that you want to make sure that the information that you get from it will be useful to you. Otherwise, it's just throwing away the money. So if you have a plan and understand what you would do if it came back negative or what you would do if it came back positive, then that would be useful. We don't recommend doing screening tests kind of just to find out unless it will change something that you do. The information in and of itself without putting it into action doesn't help. A really good reason not to get a scan if you're going to use it as an excuse to continue unhealthy lifestyle habits. So if you're a smoker and you want to check the scan and if it's okay and there's no calcium, you're going to say, that's okay, I don't have to stop smoking. You do have to stop smoking. It's bad for your health, even if your arteries don't show it yet.
Dr. Pam Douglas, thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome.
Dr. Pamela Douglas is director of the Cardiovascular Imaging Program at Duke University's Clinical Research Institute. And as she suggested, one downside of the increase in scans and other tests is that it can lead to what's known as incidental findings. Dr. Lincoln Berland of the University of Alabama took a very close look at the impact of those unexpected abnormalities that can show up during a CT or MRI or even an X-ray. When we spoke to him in 2012, he said that the fear of litigation or just the fear of uncertainty can often lead to unnecessary treatments.
They're so common and they're so frequent that they lead to a considerably large number of additional examinations and even procedures. And even though commonly the approach is, or the culture is, to be better safe than sorry, in fact, people don't fully appreciate that sometimes you're putting patients at greater risk and incurring greater costs by pursuing these incidental findings, most of which turn out to be completely insignificant.
You have a great nickname for these. What do you call them?
We call them incidentalomas, at least in our slang for them is that.
So are these things that these incidentalomas, are they found when, you know, let's say I'm getting an MRI for one reason, and this is a totally different finding, or are these usually kind of attached to whatever you're looking for?
No, sir. The definition of an incidental finding is something that is unexpected when you're looking for something else. And the problem is that because it's not related to the particular condition you're looking for, it's hard to know whether it's important or not, because often the findings just aren't clear enough to understand immediately what it is, whether it's a small tumor, just a cyst, or something like that.
So how frequently do radiologists find incidentalomas?
Extremely frequently. The quality of CT and MRI and other imaging studies has increased so dramatically that it's possible to see small things that we just couldn't see early in the days of these imaging modalities. So in older patients, there is something on almost everybody. In sort of an average asymptomatic population, there may be findings in as many as 40% of patients. When you sort of sort those out and try to figure out which ones might be important, then sometimes you're concerned about as many findings in 5% of patients. So they're extremely common.
Mm-hmm. So in the report, you write that part of the problem regarding incidental findings is that doctors are often unwilling to accept uncertainty, even when there's little chance that the finding is serious. Tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that.
A common example would be a renal cyst. Renal cysts occur in the majority of adults, and they're small and they're dark on the CT scans. And when they're small, you can't really tell whether they're solid or cystic. A cyst is not important at all and doesn't need to be followed up. If you have a cyst that happens to be a little brighter just from a single scan, you might not know whether that's a solid lesion or just a cyst that has a little blood clot in it that's also not significant. So these are the kinds of things we encounter on a day-to-day basis. The issue is what to do about them. So there's this psychology that says that, well, you know, if there is a tiny fraction of 1% of a chance that this could be a tumor that 10 years from now could grow and kill the patient, I'm going to say something about it and have them do something about it. Well, that means that, you know, 99.9% of the time you're going to be doing other exams. It could expose the patient to risk, the risk of intravenous contrast material, allergic reaction, leading to further operations and other kinds of conditions. So on average, you're really hurting more people than you're helping by following findings like that that are so unlikely to be anything important.
So why are doctors so unwilling to accept uncertainty?
I think it's part of the medical culture. And if you ask many physicians, though, what they're likely to say is that they want to be better safe than sorry, or they're very concerned that if it turns out to be anything in future years, that they might have a malpractice suit brought mm-hmm. against them. So what's constantly brought up by doctors is the risk of medical malpractice litigation, when I actually think personally that it's simply the psychology. Patients are unwilling to accept the uncertainty. Physicians are unwilling to accept the uncertainty. People don't look at things as a statistical issue. They look at something as what's happening to an individual patient. And if there's any chance that something is important, they want to pursue it without giving enough thought, in my opinion, to what the potential risks are versus the potential benefit.
Dr. Lincoln Berland is a professor emeritus and vice chairman for quality improvement and patient safety at the Department of Radiology at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. And if you've had one of those low-cost scans, we'd love to hear about the experience. Post your story at our Facebook page, or you can contact us via our Sound Medicine website. That's soundmedicine.org.
Sound Medicine's coverage of advances in cancer research and therapies is presented in part by Roche Diagnostics, doing now what patients need next.
I'm Eric Metcalf, and your Sound Medicine stat for the day is 2. A new disease may be poised to invade the country. It's not usually fatal, but it is something you don't want to have, or for that matter, to spell. Called chikungunya, the viral disease has nothing to do with chickens. Rather, it's spread by mosquitoes. Symptoms typically include joint pain and fever that go away on their own within a week or so, but the joint pain can linger. For several years, a few people in the United States were infected with the virus each year, but all had recently been abroad, mostly in Asia, where it's more familiar. In the past year, cases have also struck throughout the Caribbean. And in Florida, chikungunya just hit an important milestone. Two people came down with the disease but hadn't traveled abroad. That means they caught it from an infected mosquito in the area. Good news! Experts at the CDC suspect that this virus may not spark widespread outbreaks. Also good news, preventing it requires just one simple strategy. Don't let any mosquitoes bite you. That was the number 2, and I'm Eric Metcalf.
Coming up, we'll talk about treatments for migraines, plus how the right to try laws could be a way to sidestep the FDA.
This is a bit of an experiment in public policy as much as it is an experiment in medical care.
And later, they're back. The intrepid doctor duo of Aaron Carroll and Rachel Vreeman are out with their third book, Busting Medical Myths. And this time, they take on sex.
It always amazes me that when you look at the studies where men self-report, their penises are much larger than when someone actually goes and checks. And then I'm always amazed that they actually do studies where people go and check.
You're listening to Sound Medicine.
Health news headlines are presented in part by the Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine in Indianapolis.
Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Let's check in with Jill Dittmeyer for this week's health news headlines, plus some other health news.
Thanks, Barb. The death toll in Africa from the Ebola virus is closing in on 700. The Peace Corps announced that it is temporarily evacuating several hundred volunteers from the three hardest-hit countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. And two volunteers in Liberia have been hospitalized because they came in contact with someone who later died. We spoke with infectious disease expert Dr. Nasia Safdar of the University of Wisconsin.
I think one of the things that is somewhat hopeful with Ebola is that there haven't really been any reports of somebody who's been able to be contagious while they're incubating the illness. So all the contagiousness has happened once they already developed symptoms. And that's been helpful, as you have no idea who's out there who might be incubating Ebola until they actually get symptoms.
Dr. Safdar told me there's so much we still don't know about how Ebola is spread.
Well, so we know that humans and the non-human primates, like gorillas and chimpanzees and the like, will get Ebola and will get sick from it. But we don't know what are the reservoirs of animals that will harbor Ebola and not get sick, but be able to transmit it to other individuals. And I haven't really seen any progress on that front or even a theory about what the likely suspects are. The other thing we don't know is what body fluids are most contagious. And so at this point, one should assume that all body fluids are equally contagious. And that means a lot of barrier precautions.
Is there any research, current research being done on that? I mean, it seems like a very difficult thing to research.
It is, because it does pose a hazard to somebody who's doing research on it. You know, you don't want to be growing the virus up live, for example, and exposing lab workers to it. So that is a challenge. But on the other hand, you know, research methodology has progressed very rapidly in the last decade. And so there are definitely groups of people who are working feverishly on trying to identify it. But because it comes with a huge risk to the individual studying it, those groups are not as many as one might hope.
Dr. Nasia Safdar is Medical Director of Infection Control for the University of Wisconsin Hospital. And finally, three states have now passed the so-called right to try laws in the past 2 months. Colorado, Missouri, and Louisiana now allow terminally ill patients to try experimental drugs, even if they haven't been approved for that use by the FDA. Similar measures are under consideration in several other states. I spoke recently with Sound Medicine's bioethicist, Dr. Eric Meslin, about how the laws would work.
As you may know, people who are suffering at the end of life of terminal illness and really have nowhere else to go to get medical attention, that everything has pretty much failed for them, do have the ability to apply to the FDA for what's called compassionate use of a medicine. And it's a somewhat complex regulation and process that they have to go through. And a number of people have been dissatisfied with the pace and the speed that the FDA has been taking to approve some of those compassionate use applications. So some states are now experimenting with what is now being called a right to try log, letting a lot of that bureaucracy fall by the wayside, hopefully, and let patients, you know, find a physician, get permission, and get started on one of these experimental medications much more quickly.
Let the bureaucracy fall aside. That sounds impossible.
Well, you know, in a way, it is and it isn't. To be perfectly honest, the FDA has done a pretty darn good job over the last few years of streamlining the process of giving patients and physicians the opportunity to try out some of these medicines. It really involves four partners: patient, physician, FDA, and drug company. And all four have to be in agreement. A drug company has to let their medicine be used in an unusual way. Compassionate use is the way that they're allowing it now. But even in these right-to-try states that where the legislation is being attempted, drug companies will still have to let some of their medicine be used. So there's still bureaucracy, but they're trying to limit it.
And why would a drug company want to do that when they've got a drug that they're testing and they hope to make money off of and help people? Why would they want to be part of this?
Well, it's not clear, other than for good public relations, why they'd want to be involved in it. They've been admittedly very nervous about letting any Tom, Dick, or Harry just say, we'd like to try one of your medicines that are currently in a clinical trial. The trial hasn't been done. You haven't even applied to the FDA for permission to market or license it. We'd like early access to it. Understandably, a drug company would be a little skittish about that. On the other hand, there's good science that shows that they can allow some of their medicines to be used for compassionate, i.e. humanitarian use. So what we're seeing in these right-to-try laws is a much more, hopefully, streamlined process. I've got to tell you, I'm a little concerned about it. And my concern is in two parts. First, I don't know that the compassionate use provision is all that broken. Every single application that's been made to the FDA has been approved. Now, if you're the parent of a dying child, you may think that 24 hours is too long to get access. You want it in 2 days. So there will always be a dispute about how long it takes. But what I worry about is that it may become a little bit of a Wild West out there. You know, I got to find a doctor, doctor's got to convince a drug company, and away we go. At least with the compassionate use model, we've got a bit more control. And I think my second reason is we have to have some trust and faith in the U.S. system for testing medicines. We have one of the best systems in the world. We run clinical trials. We place an awful lot of emphasis on informed consent and ethics review of studies. Our medical schools are primed to do this. So that system is still working pretty well. It's actually one of the few instances where I think if people look carefully, they'll see that the system works.
Will those states then that pass the right to try laws, will they do away with the compassionate use laws?
It's not clear what they'll do. In some ways, this is a bit of an experiment in public policy as much as it is an experiment in medical care. And that's because it's often seen as an add-on or as an additional feature. If the compassionate use thing doesn't work, let's try this even faster track. There's only a few states that have tried it. So I think what we're all waiting to see is whether these states are going to proliferate or whether this is going to die on the vine.
And what are some of those specifics then with the right to try? Because obviously, if you have a dying child or a family member, you automatically think you need that help right now.
Well, absolutely. And honestly, if you know, heaven forbid it would be one of my children, and I think any parent would jump at the chance to take every effort, every resource available to them to try and find that medicine. In fact, one of the most famous cases led to one of the key lobbyists, the Abigail Alliance, that is leading the charge for these, all falling from this worry and fear that the system is too slow to respond. And the system, ironically, is too scientific, requiring too many criteria for people to come into studies. So in some ways, what this is supposed to do is allow for the physician, the patient, a willing drug company to be able to undertake what the FDA allows to do, but on a slightly slower basis.
And what's your forecast with this?
I'm not very good at predicting, although it doesn't stop me from trying. I have a feeling that this is likely going to be a bit of a flash in the pan. What it will probably do, it could be a win-win all the way around. A few states might actually start to be serious about it passing these laws more than the few that have already done so. And that may alert the FDA to maybe correcting some of the problems that are perceived, to doing a better job of communication, and perhaps to fast-tracking more of the medicines. The one fly in the ointment, Jill, is that we can't force drug companies to make medicines available. They also have to be partners. So maybe there's an incentive in there for the pharmaceutical industry to want to play ball.
You also have the influx of social media, of people getting online and posting their problems and kind of going after the drug makers. How far can they push?
Well, that's probably one of the great untested questions. What is the power of the internet, of Facebook and Twitter and all the other platforms? It, I think, has been a surprise to many in the regulatory world just how powerful social media can be. I'm rather pleased with the use of social media in that way. I think it is supposed to be a democratizing platform. But what it can't be is just a platform for drowning out all the other voices. So one of the things that worries me about using social media is that it might be eventually controlled by a smaller and smaller group of advocates and lobbyists, leaving the John Smith and Mary Jones who just want to find some help for their child, out in the dark.
And what do you see for people who are willing to wait if something like this takes precedent? That drug companies do jump ahead with some of their drugs and offer them up.
Yeah, this is, I think, one of the most challenging and heart-rending parts of the whole story, which is as much as we want to talk about the regulations and the policies and the rules and waiting, we're talking about human lives. And for someone who has a dying child or a dying parent or even a friend or a relative that they want to help, it is just tragic that any amount of perceived waiting, and there is no magic number. How long is too long? It's longer than right now. That's too long. Because I couldn't think of anything more horrific than knowing that there might have been a medicine for someone that was not available for technical or policy reasons. On the other hand, there is a flip side that I don't think people fully appreciate, which is rushing so quickly to trying out an untested medicine could be more dangerous than waiting for the medicine that has been tried in a clinical trial. And as I say, we have one of the largest clinical trial systems in the world. In fact, we don't have enough people in clinical trials. We need more, not less. So maybe a better job of public education and communication will help avoid these problems in the future.
So we'll have to keep an eye on those states and see what happens down the line. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Eric Messlin, director of the IU Center for Bioethics. And here's something else that probably won't be approved by the FDA anytime soon. We heard about something called oil pulling that's supposed to use coconut oil as a way to prevent cavities. Huh? So I decided to investigate for this week's Sound Medicine Checkup.
Brush up, brush up, brush up. Do I have a toothpaste? Brush up, brush up, brush up. Knocks out DK germs fast.
The technique is called oil pulling, and since it relates to teeth, it just sounds, well, painful. But periodontist Dr. Scott Reif says it's not.
You're not pulling teeth. Actually, it's a mouth rinse.
But it's nothing like Listerine.
What the procedure involves is using about a teaspoon of any kind of natural oil, like sesame oil or sunflower or coconut oil, and then swishing it around your mouth for 20 minutes twice a day.
20 minutes of oil twice a day?
It's supposed to pull the bacteria out of the gums and the dentin tubules that are in your teeth.
Ew.
This dates back about 3,000 years. Ayurveda medicine, which is a form of ancient Hindu medicine, that's what they were using at the time. And now this form of medicine is considered more of a complementary or an alternative type of medicine. And there's just not a lot of scientific evidence that I could find. I did find some case studies that were mostly in alternative medicine journals.
Dr. Reif did find a study that involved teenagers in India who rinsed with either a mouthwash or the oils. Both methods lowered the amount of Streptococcus mutans,
which is a form of bacteria associated with dental decay. However, the mouth rinse did reduce more of the bacteria than the oil.
And both required 20 minutes of rinsing.
That's a long time. And to do that twice a day, I would be personally concerned with muscle fatigue and problems with my TMJ.
And neither involved a toothbrush, which Dr. Reif reminds is vital for a healthy mouth.
You need the mechanical action of a toothbrush to break up the bacterial biofilm that's in your mouth. Bacteria not only cause dental decay, but they cause periodontal disease, which is, you know, disease of the gum tissue and the bone that supports your teeth.
So save your sesame oil for your stir fry.
It's probably not going to hurt anything to do this, but it does not take the place of brushing and flossing. You have to remember, when this was developed, there were no toothbrushes, there was no floss, and there was no toothpaste.
Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
I've been to the dentist 1,000 times, so I know the drill. I smooth my hair, sit back in the chair, but somehow I still get the chills.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Research published earlier this summer confirmed what many women have been telling their doctors for years, that migraines seem to get worse in the years before and during menopause. The findings, published by doctors from the University of Cincinnati, found that migraine headaches increased by 50 to 60% in the years surrounding menopause. Recently, Dr. Stuart Tepper of the Cleveland Clinic, who was not involved in the study, walked me through the current treatment options for migraine.
2 years ago, the American Headache Society published guidelines and reviewed all the evidence for prevention. And there are four FDA-approved drugs for prevention. Topamax is one. There's an anti-epilepsy drug called Depakote, which is a second. And two blood pressure-lowering medicines that are called beta blockers, propranolol and timolol, are also FDA-approved. But there's good evidence for other beta blockers and pretty good evidence for a couple of for another kind of blood pressure-lowering medicine called candesartan that went generic last year, and for the antidepressant Effexor or venlafaxine. In addition, some of the supplements actually have pretty good evidence for effectiveness. There's level A evidence for Petidolex, the derivative of the butterbur root, for migraine prevention, and reasonable evidence for some other supplements like magnesium.
Dr. Tepper, I'm going to interrupt you because I'm not too sure what level A evidence means.
Yeah, sorry, I spoke jargon. That's top-level evidence, and I won't go into all the details of how they arrived at it, but it's the best level of evidence.
Okay.
So multiple placebo-controlled trials with pretty strict restrictions on what is required for a good trial. Mm-hmm. If people have real frequent migraine, more than 15 headache days per month, Botox is FDA-approved for chronic migraine. That's headache at least 15 days per month, and it works great. But those are people who are more impaired by their migraines. They have more frequent migraines, and there's a little tussle that always occurs with the payers to get Botox approved.
but it doesn't have a lot of side effects, and it's given every 3 months. So that's a pretty nice deal for the patients that good insurance.
Yeah. What does the Botox do, and where do you inject it then?
Well, the FDA approved what's called the PREEMPT protocol, which is 31 injections in sites across the forehead, temple, back of the head, and neck. It's a standard protocol, one size fits all. How it works, I think, is not clear. It probably interferes or inhibits a feedback loop between external inflammation and internal nerve activation. And by interfering with the feedback loop, it really can turn off daily headache very dramatically. And it can be life-changing for patients. It's really a wonderful treatment. Your second part of your question, which is stimulators and neuromodulation and devices, there are a number of devices that are being tested for migraine. None of them has FDA approval at this point. Occipital nerve stimulators, from which electrodes are buried in the back of the head by a neurosurgeon and a battery is put in the chest. Occipital nerve stimulators are being studied for chronic migraine. And there is a device in Europe that is implanted through the mouth and stimulates an area above the mouth that has been approved in Europe for cluster headache, not for migraine, but is being studied in Europe for migraine. So there are a number of other devices that are being tested. But the hot news, the really hot news for migraine prevention, was presented at the American Academy of Neurology, and that is that there are four companies that have created monoclonal antibodies, antibodies that are directed at specific target chemicals or receptors that are associated with the genesis of migraine. And the chemical that's most noxious, the one that we really think turns on the migraine pain, is one called calcitonin gene-related peptide, or CGRP. And three of these monoclonal antibodies are directed at CGRP to soak it all up and take it out of circulation. One of these monoclonal antibodies is against the receptor for CGRP, and two of the companies presented data at the Academy of Neurology meeting that showed their monoclonal antibodies against CGRP appeared to really stop a lot of migraine with minimal side effects for up to 3 months.
So the monoclonal antibodies versus some of the more, you know, like you said, the beta blockers and antidepressants and others, side effects really minimal, but some side effects?
We don't know.
Yeah.
It's so early in the development of these monoclonal antibodies. I'll tell you what we do know. What we do know is that in the two companies that presented the data, people would get one shot. That was it, just one shot. One was intravenous, one was subcutaneous. And they couldn't tell, the people that received it could not tell whether they had the real drug or not, because there really weren't any tolerability issues with it at all, zero. They couldn't tell whether they got placebo or the real thing. And then a significant percentage of them stopped having headaches or had dramatic reductions in their headache for the next 3 months. So what we don't know is not the tolerability issue, because it looks like they're going to be very tolerable. What we don't know is, will they have any untoward side effects on the liver or on the blood vessels or anywhere that the person wouldn't know unless studies were done to make sure that their liver and their blood vessels and so on were all okay. So we're waiting for more studies on more of these monoclonal antibodies and longer studies to see that they're safe. Tolerability looks great. Effectiveness is likely. But safety, we need more data.
So folks who suffer from migraines are going to want to know where in the process these monoclonal antibodies are. I mean, when could it possibly be that they would actually be available on the market?
I think the earliest they're likely to be available is 2 years.
Okay.
And that's pushing it. I think it could be longer than that. Two of the companies are moving on to what's referred to as phase 3 trials. Those are the regulatory trials that the FDA requires, and those really take a full year, and then after the data are submitted to the FDA, it's generally another year before the FDA approves the drug. And two of the companies are just doing their phase two trials, which are preliminary before doing the regulatory trials for the FDA. So we're at the Cleveland Clinic, we're doing two different companies, two different monoclonal antibody studies. And both of the studies we're doing are phase two studies. They're not, they're pre-regulatory trials. So I would think 2 or 3 years at the earliest before these become available for our patients.
Dr. Stuart Tepper of the Cleveland Clinic, thank you so much for talking with me. It's been fascinating.
It is. It's a very interesting area that's changing very rapidly, and thank you very much for letting me talk about it.
Dr. Stuart Tepper is a professor of neurology at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine. Do you want to listen to Sound Medicine anytime? Sign up for our free weekly podcast. Click the box at our website, soundmedicine.org. You can also find us at iTunes, at Stitcher Radio, and at Swell AM. And finally this week, they are back. Doctors Aaron Carroll and Rachel Vreeman have teamed up for their third book, Busting Medical Myths. And this time, they've taken on myths about sex in a book called Don't Put That In There. And I should tell you, our conversation is PG-rated, but if you have delicate ears nearby, you might want to suggest they go watch a video for a few minutes. Dr. Aaron Carroll, Dr. Rachel Vreeman, congratulations on your new myth-busting book. This one is about sex.
Yes, it is.
And so what I try to do is I try to pick some that, you know, it would be easy to talk about on public radio.
Okay.
So let's see how this goes. Men want it more, way, way more. I think everyone has heard that men think of sex every 7 seconds, which... is impressive, isn't it, Rachel?
Well, it's an impressive number, and in fact, it's pretty much impossible. If you were thinking about sex every 7 seconds, that's really as much as you're breathing most of the time. And while, you know, people do think about sex, and in fact, statistics would suggest that over half of men think about sex at least once a day or even several times a day, it doesn't come anywhere close to every 7 seconds.
Well, have they ever measured how often women think of sex?
Absolutely. And while statistics do report slightly lower percentages in terms of how often they're thinking of it, it's not nearly as different as you might think.
Okay, next one. Let's talk about aphrodisiacs.
Okay.
Oysters.
Yes.
Chocolates. Bananas.
Well, there's lots of myths and lots of things that people will say that, you know, things will make it more likely for them to be aroused. And part of it is got to be some kind of placebo effect. I mean, you know, the idea that if you think you're going to be more aroused, you might absolutely happen. And that's often what people will say is this works for me. And that's great if it works for you. And it's great if it were, you think it works for other people. But what they're really getting at is if I gave this to somebody else and they weren't already predisposed to becoming more aroused, would this make it more likely that they would? So could I get a gain from somebody else, theoretically? And
origins.
That never works. Never, 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 ever works. Never, ever, ever
so,
works.
So what origins of this? I mean, why well, with oysters?
The, with the
why
oysters,
chocolate?
And this is where public radio is going to get a little sketchy, but with the oysters, the belief is that part of it is visual, that the oyster in some way looks perhaps like female genitalia. Some of it has to do with taste, that the salty taste could somehow also be likened to tasting bodily fluids in some way. And so there is some thought with oysters. With the other things, there are some people that believe like chocolate somehow stimulates endorphins or releases other chemicals in the brain, which somehow have something to do with also the pleasure centers that would also be related to sex. But these are all theoretical where we're trying to explain what people have already decided is truth. And when we look at just the truth before that, there's no evidence and no studies that show if we sort of double blind or give people this and they don't know about, are they more likely to come aroused? The answer to that is no.
All right. All right, Rachel. You shouldn't have sex before a big game.
Well, this seems to be a really common idea. People have a lot of rules about what their athletes should be doing before a big game or how you should prepare before a big competition. And yet a lot of the ideas for why you should be abstaining are just not true. First of all, the average encounter takes far, far less energy than people might think. In fact, if you look at the cardiovascular exertion and amount of calories burned, it's about the equivalent to climbing 2 sets of stairs. And no one would say that an athlete should, you know, make sure they don't walk up the stairs before a big game. Another worry is that it will somehow use up your testosterone, or that it's a better thing if you let that frustration or testosterone or energy build up, because then you might be, you know, performing better next week. Maybe you'd be more aggressive in your game or whatever. The truth is actually on the other side of that. A study actually suggests that testosterone levels are higher for men who have engaged in sexual activity the night before than they were for those who didn't. So if somehow that testosterone boost is helping you, it's only going to help you if you were actually involved rather than if you abstained. Now, the one thing where this could come into play is if in your encounter it's extremely emotionally exhausting, or, you know, if it's really something that's creating psychological tension or throwing you off in terms of your mental state in that way, it's certainly possible that that kind of distraction could be bad for you. On the other hand, if it's something that helps you relax and get in a better frame of mind or is part of your normal activity, it might have the opposite effect.
You know, another one that's just pervasive is if you want a baby boy, you do this. If you want a baby girl, you do this. You go to a vacation in a warmer climate or a colder climate.
Yeah, well, I think that everything works about 50% of the time. And so this is one of those. What's awesome about this myth is that I think if you ask people which of these activities produces a boy or a girl, they're almost always sure that they know what the correct answer is, but they almost don't always give you the exact answer. Right. They're sure that this position will give you a girl. Yes, other people are sure that that same position gives you a boy. If you talk to them about if you have sex early or you know, long before ovulation, well, some people will say, well, the sperm that are males are nimbler and faster. So therefore, you know, if you have sex at certain times, the men with the boy sperm will get there first. Then they'll say, other people say, but the boy sperm are less hardy. So therefore, you have it at different times of the month, the boy sperm won't get there first. The girl sperm will get there first. And it's all irrelevant. Nothing has ever been shown in any studies at all to be able to predict or make the sex of one shot over the other more likely. If that was the case, we'd all know and people would be doing it. But the truth of the matter, again, is everything works perfectly about 50% of the time, and we just have no way to make this go one way or the other.
All right, Dr. Rachel Freeman. Dr. Eric Carroll had confessed that he believed in that 10-year difference in sexual peaking. Any of the myths in this book that you believed at one time?
Well, it's certainly there are plenty that I believed, I have to say. The idea of don't leave your socks on. So,
yes.
Of course, it seems like it would be such a lame thing
that
to
one
do,
I
right?
Hadn't
like if you
heard. I have to admit,
oh,
that's
really?
A new one on me. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's a whole, the whole phrase would be like knock your socks off, right? You should, you know, if it's going to be pretty sad if you're there in your pajamas or socks or whatever. And yet, there's interestingly enough a study that actually looks at orgasms in men and women that suggested that there might be a good reason to leave your socks on, or the equivalent, something that makes you comfortable. The study was really interesting because they actually were looking at people's brain activities while they were with a partner trying to stimulate them to orgasm. And apparently it was very cold in the room where they were doing these scans, and a lot of people were complaining about cold feet. So as part of this, as it happened, they started to offer people socks or not offer them socks, and that became part of their study. And they actually found that 80% of the participants who were offered socks were able to have orgasms, whereas only 50% of those without socks were able to do so, suggesting that people who were more comfortable, who had warm feet, were more able to have orgasms. The interesting part of the study is they were looking at how different parts of the brain were functioning while they were trying to come to a sexual climax. And interestingly enough, it seemed to be connected that, first of all, that if you were more comfortable, you were more able to come to orgasm. And this seemed particularly true for women, that women were more likely to be able to have orgasms if other parts of their brain centers, the parts that might be, say, anxious about something or worrying about something else or thinking about other things, those centers needed to be essentially deactivated or disengaged from for them to be able to have orgasms.
And then, of course, that's where the socks come in.
Exactly. So if it makes you comfortable, fine, go for the socks.
But that one's a great one because I just assumed that there was no difference. That like the, when we dispelled the myth, that we would just find that there was no difference.
Well, and it goes
turns
in
out
the opposite
direction is true.
Exactly.
That's what's sort of amazing about that is
Agreed.
It's not just that wearing the socks makes no difference. It turns out making the socks might actually help.
Right.
Okay, well, I picked all the ones I was interested in, and there's plenty more. Any that I didn't ask you about that are just your favorites?
You know, you can never go wrong with how large are men's penises, what's the average penis size one. You know, it's funny because I feel like we've written this chapter multiple times, and it never, ever gets old enough. It's just
This is in another book, or is that what you're saying?
Well, we wrote, this was actually, I think, the first chapter of our first, we expanded it.
No, it was hands, that was foot size.
No, that was hands and foot size. Right, yeah, but people are consumed with penis size. We should just leave it at that. Men and women seem to be very obsessed with it, but it always amazes me that when you look at the studies where men self-report,
amazing.
Their penises are much larger than when someone actually goes and checks. And then I'm always amazed that they actually do studies where people go and check. But they do happen with tons and tons and tons of men. And it always seems to be the same thing, that when they're actually having somebody else check, that the size is a little bit less.
Oh, and does it matter?
No. Well, yeah. It's like that's mixed science. That's a jaded question. Does it matter just in the sense that, like, you know, is there a linear relationship between size and happiness? Absolutely not.
Well, and one of the interesting things with that is that many more men report being dissatisfied with their penis size than women report being dissatisfied with their partner's penis size. Essentially, the women are fine with it, but the men are really concerned that somehow they're not matching up.
Yes, I think that that's absolutely true. And I think that this is, you know, it sort of goes to show that this is one of those where I think men have created the problem and continue to pay the price for it. I don't think this is necessarily being driven by women.
Dr. Erin Carroll and Dr. Rachel Riemann, author of Don't Put That In There, your latest book about debunking myths. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That was Dr. Erin Carroll and Dr. Rachel Riemann. This is their third book together. We'll post links to the conversations about books 1 and 2 on our website. Just go to soundmedicine.org. And that's it for this week's program. We're always interested in what you'd like to hear about on Sound Medicine. You can post comments about today's program on Facebook or submit questions we might answer on future shows. Sound Medicine's senior producer is Nora Hyatt. Eric Metcalf prepares our interviews. Chris Lieber records and edits our program, and he chooses our music. Jen Berman manages our website as well as all things social media. Steve Ali of Jazzville Studios wrote our theme music. And the executive producer is Eric Eggleton. Sound Medicine is a copyrighted 2014 production of the Indiana University Trustees and WFYI, Metropolitan Indianapolis Public Broadcasting Incorporated, all rights reserved. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Thanks for listening. For more information about anything you heard on this podcast, please go to our website, soundmedicine.org. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.